Well, thank you very much. That's Eric Church with his Drink a Little Drink, Smoke a Little Smoke. And being a country and Western artist, is he espousing American values? I don't know. There's probably a measurable percentage of people out there who think that that's probably what we're doing here in talking about sovereign living and disconnecting from this colossus of a civilization that we have put together. But I think the whole point is we have to reestablish our individual identities and become individuals again and resist this push to make us just simply another part of the collective. You know, there's that thing called collectivism. I don't know. The human condition is fraught with flaws and contradictions and just absolute wonderful inconsistencies. The thing about it is all of those things that can be negatively portrayed when you label them like that. It's automatically negative. But you know, that's what progress is. Progress individually and progress as a civilization is all of this stuff swirling together, just sort of like a great big bang, only on an individual and ultimately local level. I like what what Andrea in Canada was saying about that. Really, it's the thing that's the most necessary now is to remind ourselves every day that we are in fact individuals first and part of the greater scheme secondly. If we turn loose of our individualism, what do we really have to bring to the party? Then there won't be anything left to do except drink a little drink and that other thing too. All right, we'll be right back. Got a couple of calls from Hawaii. Please, everybody, just hold your position. We're going to get to everybody as we carry on through Saturday night and on into Sunday morning with John Bush and Catherine Bleich, the Blush family. And their website is, take a look, sovereignliving.com and sovereignliving.tv. And then Catherine has her own site, CatherineBleich.com, CatherineBleich.com. Be right back. Stand by. This is Coast. John and Catherine, you sure have a lot of people out there. They're buzzing around like yellow jackets just ready to sting something. I'm getting stuff even on the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871. I'm still going through that one. I missed that in history class. Anyway, let's bring on Shepherd from Columbus, Ohio. Oh, wait a second, Shepherd. Hang on. Don't go to Shepherd yet. Hold on, brother. Let's go to it looks like Kauai, maybe Gary. He's Hi, west. John. Yeah, there you are.
Yeah, you are. With me? I'm with you. Reception's okay.
I'm trying. I'm hanging on my bloody fingernails. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Hopefully I can be somewhat brief, but I have a tendency to ramble on. But
you.
This is for John and Catherine, the question. Pretty much, and I hope I start off briefly like I did with your screener. And it's kind of like, aside from talking about the military, let's talk about industrialization and how with sovereignty, self-sufficiency, the ideals that were presented by them, how can we incorporate the industrialization as we know it today, instead of having the 2.5 acre ranch with you know, blah, 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 and blah, 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 the chickens and the, I can do both, you know, and I would like to know what their foresight is into, you know, who's going to be paving the roads, or are we going to be in, you know, hey, where's the horse, and here we go down a dirt road type of thing, or do we incorporate what's available to us so that we still can maintain some of the tools and equipment that have brought us to where and how we live today, so to speak. Did I make myself kind of clear?
I think you made yourself perfectly clear, and I think it's an excellent question. First and foremost, I would say, you know, a lot of our industrialization of our society involves, you know, massive stores making little trinkets for cheap. And so the first thing you could do is shop from local vendors. You know, here in Austin, Texas, you can find handmade jewelry, handmade furniture, all sorts of fantastic things. There's an awesome bookstore called Brave New Bookstore in Austin, Texas, bravenewbookstore.com. They are very like-minded to us. And, you know, so you can stop shopping at the big box places and go to places and people who are doing things on their own. Now, when it comes to, you know, living, let's say, in an apartment in the city, you can do things like join a community garden. You could try and convert some of your electric to solar, or you could set up a rainwater storage collection system up on your apartment patio. So there's certain little steps that you could take on your own. You could also do things like I've done. I no longer buy expensive organic shampoo. I do what's called the no-poo method. I use baking soda and apple cider vinegar. Baking soda as the shampoo, apple cider vinegar as the conditioner. There's little tiny steps you can make. But when it comes to the things that we all share as a community, like the roads, I really do think that each individual community is probably going to deal with that in a different way. John and I do live in a ETJ, which was referred to earlier by a caller, which is kind of on the outskirts of the city in Austin. And our street has potholes all the time. And I see no reason why our neighborhood couldn't take ownership of our street and once every 6 months or once every 2 years, however often it's needed, go out, fill the potholes, and take care of the roads ourselves. So ultimately, who will build the roads? People will build the roads just as they do now. The money to build them will just not be taken coercively at the point of a gun, ultimately. If you don't pay your taxes, they will come bang down your door and take you away and lock you up. So that is where we have the problem. We have no problem with people pooling their funds together and paying someone to build roads. The problem is when it is done at the point of a gun.
And we're by no means Luddites or anti-technology or primitivists. And living a sovereign lifestyle doesn't necessarily preclude, going to the grocery store down the road or getting a computer at the Best Buy. We do, however, encourage individuals to gain at least a base knowledge in a variety of different areas. So if they are caught in a situation where they aren't able to rely on an existing institution or a big box store or even an expert, they have a base knowledge to learn on their own and get by with the foundation of, for example, starting a fire without having matches or a lighter or slaughtering a chicken in your own backyard or starting vegetables from seed. So we don't necessarily have to avoid industry or, global industry altogether. We just want to exist in an environment where people aren't 100% dependent on those institutions should they fail, because they are vulnerable. Food supply chains are vulnerable. Medical industrial complex is vulnerable as well. It'll be put to the test with Obamacare, that's for sure. But we just want people to have a baseline knowledge on how to get by should those industries be unavailable someday.
And if people want to participate in those industries voluntarily and they opt into it and they choose it, that's fantastic. But when you look at big corporations, let's take Walmart, for example, they come into small towns and they are given tax incentives to set up shop there. And in the end, it puts small businesses out and they are given an unfair advantage. So, there are people in government picking winners and losers, and that is something that we have a moral problem with.
And a practical problem with.
Practical as well.
You know, I have been just kind of taking all of this in, taking the comments from the listeners and your own comments on this, and then combining them with a few shreds of my own thoughts. And what I'm thinking here is, it's almost as though it's all right for the apparatus to run. You just don't want to be absorbed into it and lose your individuality. And again, there's the enforcement part. You don't want to live within a system where you are forced to do things. Mm-hmm. And really all the things that you're forced to, with the exception of violent crime, it's all pretty much money-based. But I'll tell you, what I'm thinking here is I'm wondering how you hold on. I mean, we have built an extremely complex society here. And I just get the feeling, and correct me if I'm off base here, but I get the feeling that most of the ideas that come forth from persons who want to somehow straighten things out in the country, it involves going back going back to the 50s or going back to the 1800s or going back to the 30s or going back to the year before the, well, maybe not that one, but because of, well, you know, the 1418 war hadn't started yet. That was right after the Federal Reserve was established. It was kind of a coincidence. I'm just wondering, I don't understand how we can be a part of the apparatus and yet separate from it. It seems to me like one or the other, because there are these three different levels we operate on. We have the ones that are continuously involving us in undeclared wars. Then we have the shall we say local governance, including not only our state representatives and senators and so forth, but our judges and our councilmen down here in these individual cities and so forth. It almost seems as though we have a system that's set up that we're just going to have to deal with it, whether it improves or whether it deteriorates. I'm thinking it's not going to be changed. It's almost taken on a life of its own, and it's either going to get better or it's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's definitely something that's worth some deep analysis, especially if we are to come up with a practical way to get from here to there. And, you know, I've come to kind of a synthesis with my thinking in the realm of anarchism and voluntarism. I think the word voluntarism is a wonderful way to describe the philosophy that we subscribe to. It essentially means that all human interactions, associations, and contracts should be voluntary and not coercive, and people shouldn't be forced to participate. But one thing I've come to realize, I think it'd be a good synthesis, a good middle ground, is, you know, as a libertarian, as a voluntarist, I don't necessarily have the right to take away from someone their comfort in government. Not everybody wants to have the personal responsibility that comes along with a genuinely free society. So a middle ground that I would like to explore, and we're actively trying to create this here in Central Texas, and it's happening all over the country, all over the world, really. What if we had an environment of toleration where you only paid for those institutions which you felt benefited your lives? For example, I would still pay into the local municipal fire department. Me and my brother go play frisbee golf every once in a while at the city park. I would be happy to pay a fee for that. I would even pay the gas tax to subsidize the roads, because I don't think it's that big of a deal to pay for this central system to pay for the roads. Absent the government, of course, there would be private community or market to solve that. But I don't want to pay for the foreign wars. I don't want to pay to invade Syria. I don't want to pay for the municipal police department, which has locked me up twice for free speech issues, which every summer kills a few unarmed young black men. And I don't want to pay for the health and human services or any of that stuff. I feel perfectly comfortable with my own health care. So I think if we could create an environment where people weren't forced to participate in institutions, yet they weren't able to engage in the free rider problem, we might be able to build something. And if that environment was allowed to flourish, it's my estimation that it wouldn't be long before the voluntary institutions that are able to rise up. Because with the status quo, they have a monopoly, and they don't let people come and compete with them in the institution of defense, for example. But if we were allowed these competing institutions, I think people would find that those that are based on voluntary interaction, rather than forcing people to participate and forcing one size fits all on everyone, they would probably be better at fulfilling people's wants and needs and solving our common problems. And I think people would flock to those institutions. So I'm hoping to find a middle ground where people that want to have the U.S. Constitution, people that want to pay into a centralized healthcare system, or people that want to be defended by the municipal police, by all means, go right ahead. Just please, please, please don't force it upon my family and I. We're perfectly content with taking care of ourselves.
I got you. All right, let's go to Terrence in Chattanooga. That's a nice series of points, John.
Thank you.
Terrence, what's up?
Good morning, John, and Catherine. And,
good morning.
John and Catherine, I've been following you, not stalking you, but for several years, 2008, the Ron Paul campaign, looking for land for people to go. You being there in Texas, and you have that councilman on, and you have the perfect opportunity, maybe missed, to ask him the one question of what facts and evidence does he rely on that prove that his government code can be applied to you in your land? And you've got Randy Kelton, Eddie Craig, Mark Stevens, Rod Class, Alfred Adask, all with these law things. Do you have any victories, or have you been able to hold off, the code enforcer, that doesn't have a warrant that comes on your land and tries to apply a code, that he has no facts that the code applies to you at all. Have you had any success, or are you working in that direction?
Yeah, that's a wonderful school of thought. There's many great thinkers. You mentioned some of them. Randy Kelton, they do their Rule of Law radio show. Mark Stevens with the No State Project. He's a good friend of mine. And essentially the premise is written into the language, these codes and these ordinances and many pieces of legislation, in fact, they only apply to corporate persons. They don't apply to the human being, the physical form, the human being. And you know, sometimes that could work if you display your case really strongly. But for me, it's an is-ought fallacy. It's an ought-is fallacy. Just because that's the way things ought to be according to the law doesn't necessarily mean that's the way things are. And you could go into a courtroom and you could argue till you're blue in the face, and you could be totally right. A good example is the income tax. It even says in the tax code that it's voluntary compliance. It's not supposed to even apply to people's wages, because that's an even exchange for labor for money. There's no gain. There's no corporate gain or profit that's made. But you go into a courtroom and you try to argue that, even though that's what the law says, and the judge doesn't care because the status quo is one where people are forced to comply, people are forced to participate. And the same thing goes with saying that it's a code. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I'm more interested in exploring ways that we can gain strength in numbers. We can build communities where we're strong enough to insulate ourselves from those bureaucrats, to the point where they come knocking on your door. You put an alert out to your Liberty Bell network, and you have 50 people that show up and blockade them from physically entering your property. That's something I've been exploring in my head. I don't know how practical or what it would actually turn out, so I hope it wouldn't turn into a Ruby Ridge situation. But I'm personally not content on just relying on legal maxims in order to find freedom. I'm more interested in finding the practical freedom where I can find security regardless of what a judge thinks the law means or doesn't mean.
Oh, yeah, that's the real casino is the courts.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah, right. We have not had any inspectors come to our property or anything, and, you know, maybe after the show they will, who knows. But it hasn't been an issue, and we are just living free, and we are doing our thing. And I don't know what the code is. I don't know what the laws are, and quite frankly, I don't care. I want a safe property for my family and my children to live on. And I want to grow food, and I want to have chickens, and I love my chickens and our turkey and our peafowl, and I'm going to take care of them. And if someone comes knocking on our door and has a problem, we'll address it then. But I have a feeling they're going to come face to face with a massive amount of people who support us growing our own food and living our own lives.
Let's take one real quick from, looks like, Puma, Hawaii. Ole. That's you.
Well, aloha, John.
Aloha to you.
This is a great show tonight. I wanted to call and just mention, well, I'm a Hawaii sovereign, and you hadn't mentioned at all about Hawaiian sovereignty, but I wanted to just call and tell you that it's real. You know, in Hawaii, in 1893, our legal kingdom of Hawaii was overthrown, but it wasn't overthrown legally. So we never became legally part of the United States, and we still have two governments operating. We have the Kingdom of Hawaii, and we have the reinstated Hawaiian government. And you know, they're both headed up by the Kanaka Maoli, the Native Hawaiians. But I'm not Native Hawaiian, but the rest of my family is. I'm the family kupuna or elder. And, you know, earlier councilman called in. I might mention I was elected to the Hawaii County Council in 2004, but never allowed to serve because of government corruption.
And, gotcha.
You know, what really brought things home to me, I had to get my license renewed. I had the state of Hawaii driver's license. Now they want a birth certificate, and it turns it into a citizenship document.
That doesn't surprise me somehow. Listen, I hate to leave you on hold for as long as you didn't just give you a little bit of time, but we're just about to have to take a hard break here. So thanks, Ole. So it does exist. It is possible to live under two governments at one time. Okay. We'll be right back. Our final segment here. A few more calls with you for John and Catherine, and then two or three open lines as well. Let's just see what we can do. This is Coast to Coast AM. Happy Saturday. I have to throw in this little tidbit. Yes, it's about our problem across the ocean, across the Pacific Ocean, that's being increasingly more contaminated by the day. Listen to this one. This will grab you. Fukushima farmers negotiate with Japanese government. It's a film. You can see it on ENE News. A minute and 45 seconds in Japanese, he's saying, "Do you understand the meaning of D in the word decontamination? We are just tilling deeply and spreading the radiation thinly. We are not removing the contamination. No wonder that the radiation level has not gone down. We measured the radioactivity in the air. It has not gone down at all. We have not removed the contaminated soil. Of course not. The environment has not changed at all 2 years after the explosions. In Fukushima, all farm produce must be checked for the cesium level prior to shipping. The current government limit is 100 becquerels. The farmers know how many becquerels of cesium their produce contains. We can ship them if the reading is lower than 100, but I would not dare eat them myself. The consumers assume there is no radiation in the food they buy. We farmers know better. We feel guilty about growing it and selling it. We won't eat it ourselves, but we sell it." You get me? I know you do. All right, we'll be right back. Final segment with John and Catherine in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's see if we can get four, five, six more calls in. So I would just say we want to give you all the time that we can, but we cannot give you very much. So I'll tell you what, come on board the mothership and talk to us. That's going to be John on Wild 3 in Tampa Bay. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. This is about the best program I've heard so far on Coast to Coast. And I wanted to talk to John and Catherine about the situation where they had their car impounded. And the Supreme Court seems to back up the sovereign citizen movement in stating that the right to travel is a well-established common right that does not owe its existence to the federal government. It is recognized by the courts as a natural right. That's a Supreme Court summary. And there's other ones that I have to read here. The right to travel is a part of liberty of which a citizen cannot be deprived without the process of law under the Fifth Amendment. And the right of the citizen to travel upon the public highways and to transport his personal property thereon, either by horse or carriage or automobile, is not a mere privilege which any city can prohibit or permit at will, but is a common right which he has under the right of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way you can be licensed to travel on a road is if you're conducting commerce, but because there's so many roads, there's no other way to travel freely as a result of so many roads. So it is up to our own discretion whether we use the roads or not. But if we're using it for commerce, then we would have to have a license. What does Catherine and John think about the Supreme Court backing them up?
Yeah, there was a period where I had like five traffic tickets hanging over my head. Two of them were because we were driving around in Catherine's. We called it the Sovereign Citizen Mobile because the tags were expired, and we still drove it around in Texas. The tags were in Missouri. But I did a lot of research during that time and did a lot of research into the definitions and come to find out the definition of vehicle, according to Black's Law Dictionary, is an object that's used to transport goods or persons. And then you look up the definition of transport, and it's the movement of goods or persons by a carrier. You look up the definition of carrier, and it's someone who moves goods or persons for a fee. So exactly as you said and exactly as the Supreme Court upheld, driver's licenses are really only a requirement for people that are engaging in commerce or transporting goods or persons and making a profit off of it. The only problem, again, as I said before, that I see with this particular line of thinking and believing it to be an adequate defense against state aggression is, again, it's the ought-is fallacy. Just because that's the way things ought to be, even according to the Supreme Court and the law, doesn't necessarily mean that's the way things are. And if you've had any opportunity to dabble in the funds of the court system, you'll come to find that the law is completely irrelevant in courts. All that matters is maintaining control and extracting resources from the people and tossing people in cages to further the prison industrial complex. So unfortunately, even though the Supreme Court upheld our right to travel and the liberty that we have to travel freely to pursue our happiness, it doesn't matter because the lower courts and even the juries are still going to convict you because the juries say, you know, well, I have to have a driver's license. Why should this person be able to travel without one?
Right.
That's my opinion on that. I don't rely on the courts to preserve my freedom. I'm trying to build alternatives and build community to help defend my freedom.
That's excellent. That's excellent stuff. All right. Shepherd, Columbus, Ohio, East. What's going on?
It is a pleasure. I wanted to find out if you folks are aware that original birth certificates are on file with the federal government Department of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a good friend named Gary Conisberg, the Garko Factor, that actually called up the SEC and looked up the number on the back of his Social Security card and came to find out that they were trading the corporation that represents him as an asset in the stock exchanges. So we're very familiar with that. That's why we chose not to sign the birth certificate that was given to our children. We used a licensed midwife. And what I've found often is a lot of the state regulation and the control that the government imparts upon people goes through the licensing. So it's not on Catherine and I for raising chickens and selling the eggs to private people, but we're not able to sell eggs to a licensed restaurant. Likewise, a licensed midwife who happened to have a great reputation, we wanted to go with her rather than a black market or gray market midwife. She's required by law to fill out the birth certificate. She could lose her license in her practice. So she filled out the birth certificate. We refused to sign it. And in my eyes, it has no legitimacy. If they want to try to have some corporation that follows my children around and they want to try to make a profit of it, off of it, selling it to the Department of Commerce and the stock exchange, they can do whatever the heck they want. It's invalid in our eyes. It doesn't apply to us, and we choose not to recognize it.
Gotcha. Let's go to the first-time caller line. That's Richard in Malta, New York. Richard, how are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have my radio turned down. I don't want to listen to this, but you probably do. There's the power of three, the MA, the ALA, the FBI, the CIA, the .gov, and DNA. Okay? The power of three has always been precedent in our lifetime as we know it. Okay, it's the pyramid, which points due north. Okay, the power of three represents ABC, A, power, B, greed, C, control. What happened to Dorothy Kilgallen when she was supposed to appear in front of the Senate committee to blow the media apart? Okay, it's a sovereign living. People are too busy to care. They're trying to pay their bills, their taxes, and the fear of Catch-22, which was written by Joseph Heller. Okay. There's many, many books written. Okay. Mark Booth wrote a book called The Secret History of the World. Okay. Heller wrote Catch-22 by design. All right. We are living in a society that's monetarily controlled. What does monetary mean? Monetary means that we are controlled by the power of the dollar. What appears on the dollar? The pyramid. Where does the pyramid point? Due north. Did Roswell in 1947 actually exist? Of course it did. But people, okay, are too busy, and they know down in Washington the powers that to be, okay, the 1-2-3s, that they control our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are we a monetary race? Yes. A. B, number two, are we controlled by society, which is written by the government? Yes. .gov. Okay. Where do you want to go from here?
Where do you go with that, John? I mean, do you see where he's coming from?
Yeah, and I think...
Thanks, Richard.
There's all sorts of exciting opportunities that we have now, especially with the technology the way that it is. And we personally do everything we can to limit the use of Federal Reserve notes. We try to engage in as many economic transactions as we can without using dollars, because we believe that using Federal Reserve notes gives value to the Federal Reserve system, which in turn gives credence to them printing money out of thin air, which in turn gives credence to them bailing out the big corporations and funding multiple wars of aggression all at the same time. We're big fans of Bitcoin. We like to trade in Bitcoin. We like to receive Bitcoin. We like to exchange Bitcoin for goods and services. For those not familiar with Bitcoin, it's a cryptocurrency that's traded online. It's close to being anonymous. It's so easy to use. You can transfer money worldwide, globally. And I think it has an opportunity to really undermine the central banking system. We all have the choice in our lives to choose to work for an employer that only pays FRNs or choose to live in a place where we can only pay off our ends, but it takes a little bit of work and some foresight and thinking outside of the box. But slowly but surely, we could reduce our use and dependence on this monetary system by engaging in barter, by investing in junk silver and using that. Like, for example, we trade our a dozen eggs for a silver dime. We're bringing back the old notion of a dime a dozen. Of course, silver dimes are worth like $2.50 right now. But I think that there's many things that people can do to get out from underneath the control. And we don't necessarily have to participate in their monetary monopoly. It may be difficult, and we may not be able to have a car note or work a big corporate job. But we can make changes in our everyday lifestyle, and we could opt out of these systems and begin using the alternatives that are already available to us. And I think Bitcoin's a great one. People can learn more about Bitcoin at weusecoins.com. This really cool organization, Bitcoin Not Bombs, that's trying to encourage Bitcoin use in the nonprofit sector for philanthropy. But I think all that stuff, I think it's dying. It's on its way out. There's new forms of doing things. There's new technologies. And I'm really excited to take part in exploring that and growing that.
Well, John, tell us a little bit about that here. Now, I've heard about this Bitcoin thing, and we're going to do a program on it in the very near future. But just how do you get some bitcoins to start trading? I mean, is this sort of like an electronic barter town out of Thunderdome, or what do we got here?
Well, the best way to receive, first of all, you can set up a wallet. It's an online wallet. It can exist either on your physical hard drive on a computer, or there's some online services that are easier to use, in my opinion, like blockchain.info. All you do is go up, pop in your email, put a password, and before you know it, you have a wallet. In order to receive bitcoins, you can go to Bitcoin exchanges like bitstamp.net or MTGOX, Mt. Gox, and you can purchase Bitcoins with Federal Reserve notes or any other central currency for that matter. The best way, in my opinion, to receive the Bitcoins is to offer a good or service for the Bitcoins. Say that you're a plumber, say you do web development, or as we do with the eggs. Simply trade them for goods or services, then you're bringing in Bitcoin without having to first purchase them, which could be a barrier to entry. But it's a little complicated. There's a little bit of a learning curve to get over. But once you use it, I mean, I pay this woman that helps with marketing. Her name's Megan. She helps marketing for the Center for Natural Living. And I pay her with Bitcoin. It's so much easier than writing a check or doing a wire transfer or using PayPal. The fees are so much lower. So once you get over that learning curve, I really think the phenomenal value that lies with Bitcoin is the simplicity to transfer money instantly with minimal fee. And I think it does have the opportunity to render credit card banking systems and these other forms of monetary exchange irrelevant, and they'll be left in the dust. So
now, John, I know you're not an economist, but what will this do to the, if enough people start using this, have we, two-part question, have we just exchanged one or traded one medium of exchange for another? And number two, what would it do if a sufficient number of people started using the Bitcoin system? We, the people down here, and the 99%ers down here, I take it that would collapse the current economic system, or would they just go, okay, let's go with the Bitcoin thing? Operation doesn't skip a beat. What would happen?
Sure. I mean, slowly but surely, if more people participated and stopped using the Federal Reserve note, then yes, the Federal Reserve system would collapse in on itself. And that's something that I think is one of the values of using Bitcoin, the capability that it has. If people, everyone says, oh, the Federal Reserve note is worthless. If you really think it's worthless, then you can send me your Federal Reserve notes and I'll find value in them. But the value isn't in that it's backed by a commodity, and neither is Bitcoin. The value is that people identify it and use it as a medium of exchange. Now, the cool thing, if Bitcoin were to become the norm, Bitcoin isn't controlled by a central institution that can use arbitrary dictates and benefits to their buddies in the good old boy network we've been talking about for the past few hours. It's completely decentralized. It's open source. People can
code.
There's no interest. No centralized manipulation. It's all open source, and there's really no way to manipulate it. So the value will be determined on how many people are purchasing it, how many people are exchanging it, and if it were to become the norm, I think we would find a lot more freedom. They wouldn't be able to finance all these foreign wars, and it would be more stable of a currency. It's unstable now because it's new, which, of course, would come along with any new currency. But as it becomes more mainstream, it will stabilize, and it could totally replace the dollar and every other centralized currency for that matter.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the war thing, though. You know, where there's a will, there's a weapon. Let's go to John, Wild 4 in Iowa. John, come on real quick. We're running out of show here, pal.
Hey, I got a question. Okay, I just was informed here not too long ago by somebody in my family that the cartel is very well and alive in Iowa, Sonora, and Sinaloa. What can somebody do to get these people out of this country and to take back our rights and our freedoms from this drug trade that is actually being run by the FBI and CIA to put money and drugs and firearms into these people's hands? And not only that, but to put this into the populace to get people to go to prison and to, I guess, what would I say, run the prison system. I mean, what can somebody do?
Well, there's not a lot that somebody can do. I'll throw something out there. I think that illegal means illegal. So go back and start over. That's number one. And stop encouraging illegal immigration. Regulate your border like every other country in the world does and get the population down to the ones that we know are here as citizens. And then after that, if you want something to go away, quit buying it. Listen, we're running out of time. Just quit buying it. Quit hiring people. Quit buying their damn drugs. There's the answer to that question. No demand, no market. We got to go. Catherine and John, Catherine, tell the listeners very quickly about the little treat you have from there on them on your CatherineBleisch.com site.
Today only, download my chicken ebook on CatherineBleisch.com and on Amazon for Coast to Coast listeners.
All right. CatherineBleisch.com. John, Parthian shot from you.
Yeah, I want to encourage everyone to check out episode 1 of the Sovereign Living Reality Show. We have it available for free at sovereignliving.tv. And if you like it, consider donating to our Indiegogo campaign to get a sneak peek of episode 2 and 3. Again, that's sovereignliving.tv.
Excellent. Thanks for hanging out for the whole show. I knew there was a lot to get into, and we were going to take some side trips, and we did, and it was great. And let's stay in touch with each other and hook up again in the near future, all right?
Yeah, we loved it. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks. You were a lot of fun to have. All right, tomorrow night, it's part 2 of the Zombie Jombie Weekend. We're going to have Stephen Kinzer on the program. He's a first-time guest. He's written a couple of books, The Brothers, The Dulles Brothers, and another one called Bitter Fruit. Wait till you hear this one. The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. Bitter Fruit. Heard about this 5 years ago. Get to talk to the author now. Well, not now, but today. Is where I am. It's Sunday. Hey, remember, folks, here's an important tip. The idea, the ultimate weapon is to relieve you of your faith. Once you lose that, you have no defense whatsoever. But it can't be taken. You have to allow it to be taken. So don't. And be well. And I'll talk to you tomorrow night. Mothership out.